Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guest today is Richard Williams. Richard is Professor of Contemporary Visual Culture at the University of Edinburgh. Richard, welcome to City Talks.
Thank you.
And our subject today is your fascinating new book entitled Why Cities Look Like They Do, which is a great title. And I want to start off by saying, or asking you, the answer to your question or to your point is not as straightforward as we often assume. Why is that? What are we missing when we think about the immediate answer to that question or to that issue?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think there's various answers to it, but what I wanted to do, first of all, was get away from the idea that we all habitually have about cities, which is that somebody is responsible for them. So, you know, it could be an architect or a planner or some kind of designer, but a sort of basic assumption that somebody or some bodies are responsible for it, and that cities are somehow designed or intentional. So the key thing was to think about what I've called processes. The idea that cities are often produced, or basically produced, by things that are almost unconscious. They're outside of our individual control. They're the interaction of large scale processes or events or tendencies that aren't or can't really be totally controlled.
Yeah.
So that was the key thing. And the point about the title, so why cities look the way they do, I mean, that to be honest, was that was suggested very early on by the publisher. I mean, the publisher, Polity, have been just sort of wonderful people to work with, you know, very full of good suggestions. But they were very intrigued by my interest in the visual. And both of us, we felt that you could have cities that weren't essentially designed in a conventional sense, but they might still have a very powerful visual impact. Mm. And I think that, you know, in everyday discussions about cities, we're very quick to think about parts of cities being ugly,
yep,
or beautiful. You know, we're very quick to jump on things that are eyesores or, you know, hideous or whatever. So it's very often the visual that activates our engagement with,
yeah,
cities.
Yeah.
So it's really those two things. It's the process and it's the visual, and it's the interaction of those two,
yeah,
those two things.
And in the book, you highlight a number of processes, which will come on to as well. And I think it was interesting reading the book because you stressed the importance of the visual, in a sense, the importance of looking. Mm. But you're also critical of the way that we look, in a sense. It's not that visual isn't important, it's that it can often be important, but not in the ways that we think it's important. I think, is that right? That seemed to be a theme that I was getting when I was, you know, reading through the book and reflecting on what you were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, obviously my interest in the visual comes out of what I do in my day job. So I'm a, you know, self-styled professor of visual culture. So I'm actually head of art history. So I mean, I've got 20 odd years in that very strange humanities discipline, which is all about looking at stuff, but it's looking in a very selective way. So to get, you know, back to your question, you know, how do we look at stuff, and, you know, is it the right way to look at stuff? Art historians tend to look in an extremely selective way. I mean, at best, they're fantastic. I mean, they're open and Catholic. They're open to anything. But it has tendencies to just select the conventionally beautiful or whatever. So, you know, what one of my the perhaps the more provocative bits of the book for art historians is my horror of Venice. You know, I hate Venice.
Well, I was going to say, you started with Venice, and you have a confession that you make early on in the book, which you say what the confession is. Let me just say, I similarly have exactly the same view of Venice as you do, but just say what you think, because I think Venice is a nice way into the meat of the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, the confession is very simple, and I hate Venice. I hate the place.
And shock horror now.
And I, you know, as an art historian, you're not really supposed to say that.
No.
I mean, I don't know how many times I've been to the Biennale. six or seven times the architecture biennale and the art biennale. I've hated every second of all of those events, and I know that's partly me, but it's also partly just feeling a huge disjunction between what you're supposed to see and what you're supposed to appreciate about the city, its extraordinary, you know, architecture and all the rest of it, and then the actual experience, which is of you know, whatever time of year you go, you know, colossal numbers of human beings all sort of crowded together in a very uncomfortable place, and then cruise ships sort of going up and down the canals and blocking out the views. I mean, actually spectacular sight, but somehow we're not allowed to see that stuff, or not able to see it properly, and a whole set of things which seem to just make for a very peculiar and contradictory and often very unpleasant experience. And it's so yeah, many things came together in Venice for me. I mean, I found that this was the great art historical city that supposedly, you know, for many people, that the model of how a, you know, a civilized city ought to be, and yet my experience was of something completely other.
Yeah, well, my experience having been there probably not as many times as you are quite similar, and it's definitely not on my you know, on my top list of cities that I enjoy visiting professionally or personally. We'll come back to Venice at the end, because which you do in the book, which to say, you know, if we follow the thread of the book, what how might we then think about Venice and look at Venice rather than how we're told to kind of think about it. So we'll just hold that. So for the purposes of the conversation, and you say this up front in the book, you could have done it a different way, and I think you're primarily talking about more globally orientated cities than necessarily some of the and we'll come towards the end where you have some reflections on Leicester, which I particularly enjoy.
Yeah.
But you're not talking about the kind of, you know, smaller, mid-sized cities. You are mainly talking about some of the bigger, and drawing examples and references from some of those more kind of globalized cities. That's right, isn't it?
It is right. And I think, you know, the brief was to do a book of, you know, 70,000-80,000 words. So it's quite short. You know, you can't talk about everything.
No.
I mean, I've travelled quite a bit, but I haven't been everywhere. So I wanted to focus on the contemporary world, and to focus on cities which had a self-conscious sense of being global.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some of them are places that you would say are, without a doubt, global cities, that they're global financial capitals, so, you know, London, New York, Paris, whatever. I mean, other places are places which maybe have global aspirations, so they're having conversations with people who are in those very large places, but they're certainly keyed into the right conversations, they're building themselves in that way. So in fact, there are one or two quite small places there. But for example, Dundee's conversation about culture
and the V&A.
Now, I mean, Dundee's a tiny place. I know it extremely well. It has all sorts of problems. Nobody would say it's a global city right now at all. I mean, maybe it was once. You know, if you like marmalade.
Yeah, jutes and jams. Yeah.
But it certainly has global aspirations, and that the museum that it built, the V&A branch that it built and opened last year by Kengo Kuma, the Japanese architect, was a very powerful statement of that. And in a large part, it succeeded in the first stage. So they got coverage from the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, it got, you know, it was one of the top 10 cities. I think maybe it was the top
I think it was the top.
In Lonely Planet.
I think it was, the best city to visit or something, or the top city to visit. I think that's right.
I mean, slightly puzzling, you know, knowing the place as well as I do, but still, it was an indicator of how a place like that has managed to insert itself in some kind of global network. So, and it's making images.
Yeah.
In terms of buildings and other stuff, images which are about putting itself in that global context.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean that. So there are places like
Dundee.
But for the most part, it's the stuff you would expect.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and culture was one of the processes that you highlight, which we'll come on to in a second. But what I find fascinating element, the reflective point in the book is you set this up by saying, which you actually you see in the economic data that that I look at and my organisation looks at, but you, you know, this idea of the return of the city, in a sense, you know, we had, you make this point in relation to London, but it applies to places across across the UK and obviously others, you know, this kind of steady decline of the urban over the pretty much most of the 20th century until we get to the, you know, to the 80s, roughly in London, and probably the 90s in places like Manchester and Liverpool. But then we see the return of the urban, urban living, urban working, becoming, you know, much more critical aspects of the modern economy. You know, your view and your perspective on that is illustrated through the explosion of images and the depictions of cities, either as, you know, people going there, you know, images in films, in pictures, or in festivals or events. And so just say a little bit about that, because I found that really fascinating, the way that urban has returned as a, you know, as something to look at.
That's a great question, because I think we often lose sight of it. The experience of my life, so I'm 52, so yeah. I mean, my life has been conditioned by this process more than anything else, I think. So I can't think of another political or social or economic process that has been quite so dramatic as the return of the city. So I grew up in the 1970s in Manchester, which was a city that you accepted as basically a ruin, and it was a place that had been bombed very heavily in the Second World War, and even, you know, a quarter of a century after the Second World War, it was a city still full of bomb sites, and it literally cleared sites everywhere. Yep. And there are some very good accounts of that. I mean, there's the novelist W.G. Zabel, who talks about that, you know, really powerfully in a novel. I think Austerlitz is the one that he talks about it. And that was certainly my experience of the place. It was a city of emptiness, of cleared sites, of bomb sites, rubble, of sort of potential, but basically emptiness. So you were acutely conscious of people living somewhere else, perhaps going in to the city centre for a certain number of limited functions, retail, whatever. But fundamentally, it was a city of voids. I mean, later on, I got to know it as a city of music and clubbing and things like that, and, you know, very very much participated in that. And you know, then you understood that underneath the rubble there was other stuff going on. Yeah. But you were also aware of that underneath the rubble being a pretty limited and self-selecting activity. So this, the big process of the return of the city, I was, you know, just nobody predicted that. I couldn't have predicted it. Maybe in retrospect we could have thought about it. And I think it was Manuel Castells, you know, indeed, great Catalan economist, sociologist really, who did start to predict that, thinking about nodes and hubs and the way that networks work. But he was a bit of an outlier. I mean, I can't think of anyone else who was really predicting that return of the city. And then when it did happen, I suppose at that point I was actually back in Manchester after a long period away, when I'd been, you know, all over the place and lived in Madrid and London and whatever. When I came back, it was a city that was still at a, you know, historically low population. But there was a sense that maybe people might start to move back. And then about, you know, 5-6 years after that, they really started to move back. And
yes.
Then, you know, I've been, you know, recently, and you know what it's like. So it's you know, not unlike what's happened in the east of London. So, you know, skyscrapers everywhere, you know, 25% growth in population.
Yep.
You know, astonishing thing to happen. And obviously we've seen that replicated you know, so many places all over the world. And you've had Ed Glaser here, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. Well, we had Richard Leese on telling us the story of that kind of renaissance. So, you know, it's a kind of, in your personal reflections, you know, reflect, obviously he had personal reflections as well, but yeah. also, you know, how the ambitions evolved of the city and, you know, itself and how it thought about itself and how that then became a, you know, self-fulfilling momentum, which is fascinating.
I think it's a story that needs to be retold. We need to hang on to it because the population shift in the, I suppose, the, you know, 40s and 50s out to suburbs in the northern hemisphere, industrialized world, was one of the biggest, perhaps the biggest population movement in history.
Yep.
And then this movement back is probably also one of the biggest population movements in history. So we need to hang on to the importance of that, you know, even though it's clearly, you know, deeply problematical in all sorts of ways in terms of how wealth gets concentrated and so on. But it's an amazing story. Yeah.
And then there's a corollary then, which you pick up, which is, you know, about how that return to, you know, to the city gets depicted in and magnified by filmmakers, by photographers, by festival organisers, by event organisers as well. I mean, and what I found, you say a bit more, but it's not only the event organisers or, you know, the architects coming back in and building their iconic buildings. We have this huge flourishing of venues and localities upon which we can view the city itself, which I found, you know, you use the Tate Modern and the platforms that would be, but it's a fascinating, just say a little bit more about, you know, about that and how that plays out.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things in what you're saying, but one is the provision of places from which you can view the city.
Yeah.
And I think I was certainly conscious somehow of being in cities, or having grown up in a city that did not have places from which you could view the city. So the idea that you know, you might have a skyline, or there might be a place where you could see a skyline, was in my experience quite limited. And yet you knew from TV in particular that the skyline might be very important in establishing a location or establishing the idea of the city as being somewhere exciting or funny or whatever. As I'm thinking particularly of American TV
and
the role of things like, you know, Seinfeld and Frasier.
Yes, yeah.
You think about Frasier. So that's kind of, you know, early 90s, isn't it? Early 90s. So it's at a point where these big demographic shifts have not exactly happened.
No.
But there's an idea of presenting the city as somewhere attractive to live, perhaps a little eccentric, but, you know, attractive and something that could be emulated. And in that, in the opening credits to Frasier, you've got the skyline of Seattle.
Yes, you have.
And he's got his apartment, and he's looking out
at
the skyline, he's got the Space Needle and all that stuff. So all that kind of thing's very important. And I think, it goes along with then subsequently building places from which you can view the city. And, you know, how interesting it is that cultural buildings, almost all cultural buildings, suddenly started building viewing platforms and towers and big windows from where you could see stuff. And, you know, they never did that before. But now they're, you know, that's mainly what they've got.
Yeah.
So, you know, what happened with Tate Modern's extension, the Herzog and de Meuron, you know, the second extension.
Yeah.
I mean, that almost all of the conversation around that was about the viewing platform. You know, not what's in it. It was about, you know, what can you see from the viewing platform? Oh yeah, and you can see into these flats and, you know, look at these extraordinary lifestyles that are the 0.0001%.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I would be amazed if the most popular bit of these new facilities, whether it's the Shard or whether it's Tate Modern or whether it's the Eye or, you know, or the Hancock Tower in Boston or, you know, whatever it might be, not Boston, in Chicago, is, you know, is the viewing tower or the bar that's often right next to the viewing tower, where you have a drink and you go and, you know, go and have a look at the city itself. I think that is definitely a modern phenomenon, I think, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. So, you talk a lot about, let's get onto this sort of central theme, which is the significance and importance of processes as a way into the visual that we focus. So start by just sort of saying, we'll get into the particular processes that you've identified or you explore in more detail, but just what you mean when you say, you know, we should think about cities as processes. What is it that you're actually, you know, trying to get across to us in that idea?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a broad idea.
Yeah,
and I'm happy to admit that. And you know, I've had questions of like this. You know, what do you mean by process? So well, but I think it's useful because it's a way of thinking about cities as being produced not by individual designers or by, you know, individuals, but by individuals responding to or interacting with many things. I mean, to put this in slightly academic terms, it's a way of getting beyond a traditional notion of authorship.
Yeah.
And I know, I mean, that's a bit of an academic cliche, but you know, I grew up with that idea as being important. So, you know, one of the things that seemed important to me in producing you know, more interesting analyses of art and culture and architecture was getting away from the idea that one genius individual might be responsible for the whole thing. And you know, so process is a way of thinking about that. And actually, process in art terms is a word that gets used a lot in the 1960s for exactly the same reason. So it's about there are many artists who get interested in process as a way of getting beyond traditional notions of authorship and sort of allowing chance and indeterminacy and, you know, randomness to inform what they're doing.
Mm.
I mean, we'll park that now.
Yeah.
But certainly process has been an idea for me for a long time as a sort of a radical idea.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
So it's that. I mean, in terms of the, you know, the actual processes, I'm thinking of, you know, we can talk in detail about some of them, but you know, a good one would be the circulation of money,
yes,
the circulation of capital. So, I confess, and it was a great pleasure to be here actually for this reason. But I confess that, you know, I spend much more time reading the financial press than I do anything else. So seriously, I do, you know, any. I mean, I'm fascinated by the way that capital markets work and capital flows and what happens, and particularly the unintended consequences of those things.
Mm.
So people, you know, act in capital markets, so thinking they know what they're doing, then very often the results are completely.
Oh yes.
Other, you know?
Oh yes.
So I wanted some reflection of those things.
Yeah.
Like that, things that are maybe unforeseen, unpredicted, indeterminate.
Yeah. And you're, I mean, you're also, which actually. Other people, just one of our recent podcast guests was Mike Batty, Professor Mike Batty from UCL, and he talks comes at it from a slightly different angle, but talks it very, you know, some of the things you're stressing through the concept of processes is about, you know, time and history really do, you know, really matter, and you know, this idea that it's the journey, not the destination. You know, we take snapshots of cities, but actually, you know, they're adapting and evolving over time, which we'll come back to. And in a sense, you know, therefore they are dynamic and fixed. And even if they're fixed at any one moment, they're never fixed for very long.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of dynamism to it as well, which we often miss when we think, because we focus on the, you know, the building or the, you know, the visual, which is by nature static.
Yeah.
We miss some of that. Is that fair? Is that right?
Yes, that is right. I mean, I certainly think of cities as dynamic, and you know, I think that any concept of a city that doesn't accept that they inevitably change is a hopeless concept.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, part of my thinking around this question comes from living in a city that you know, a big chunk of which is a UNESCO World Heritage,
which doesn't change, right?
Yeah,
and or not as much as, you know, other bits of the city have in Edinburgh.
No, I mean, and they, you know, the people responsible for keeping up that UNESCO status and also the heritage groups, the heritage lobbies that are very powerful. They're disproportionately powerful in the city, in the conversations that they have. And they have, to my mind, a totally impoverished idea of what a city actually is. I mean, I can put that more strongly.
Yeah, go on. I mean, I encourage you to say, we're on these, we're like-minded on these sorts of things. But just give me a sense of what you mean by that and how that plays out. I'm using Edinburgh as a kind of good example.
Edinburgh's an interesting example because like some of the other smaller cities I've mentioned already, it does have a sense of itself being global, at least in cultural terms. With justification.
With justification, yeah.
But it also has to my mind, it's a very poor, almost adolescent understanding of what a city might actually be. Mm. So it's a city of fixed monuments. The heritage lobby finds it extremely difficult to accept that the monumental city might actually be inhabited in a reasonable way. And I've got into lots of trouble with them over the years. I mean, they hate me, and I think the feeling's mutual, but earlier this week I did an interview for the Herald newspaper, the Glasgow newspaper, and made the point, which is that the new town, which is a big part of the UNESCO site, is scarcely inhabited. I mean, just in terms of the density of inhabitation, I mean, it looks wonderful at the moment, because over a period of 40 years really, it has been it's been well cared for. A lot of the facades have been refurbished and looked after. It has a consistency which is really unusual in a Western city. But this is a place where almost nobody lives. And there are people living in most of those buildings, but it's like sort of one person each flat. And this seems to be, no model, and yet this is that lobby is so powerful that they project that model of being into discussions about the whole city.
Yeah,
it seems completely wrong to me. So the discussions are about creating a built environment which is fixed, permanent, unchanging. Must be preserved at all costs, and something where there is a very limited sense of who might be living there, apart from people, a handful of people who think the right thoughts.
And how do you think how have we arrived at that, that situation? Or is that a kind of permanent view that it just plays out, over time? Or is that sort of heritage, places, museum to be preserved as it is, rather than, evolving into something? Is that is that always been there, do you think, Richard? Or is it become more prominent now? And
I think
worries about Edinburgh's growth and success, and we need to safeguard this stuff, because you hear this a lot in lots of different places. We must maintain our heritage, which is called for. Let's not do anything.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. It's a special sort of NIMBYism as well.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's a modern phenomenon.
Yeah.
So I mean, my colleague Miles Glendinning, who's a genius and knows more about this than anybody else, Miles has written about the way that the heritage lobby emerges along with modernism.
Right.
And it's the same people.
Right.
So specifically in Edinburgh, then you've got somebody like Robert Matthew, who is on the one hand, he's doing the redevelopment of George Square, which is the big university site, the centre of the university infrastructure. So he's doing this big modernisation, which involves some demolition, but he's also setting up heritage organisations. So it's quite curious, but there's a modernity about that. So with what's generally known as the Abercrombie Plan, which is late 1940s plan for the city of Edinburgh, there's an accommodation of both history and modernity. They can do both at the same time. What happens, I think, and Miles is really the person to talk to.
Yeah.
What I think happens is that it's part of that equation just becomes too powerful. And there's also something that happens in the mid-60s where Robert Matthews' George Square development becomes very unpopular.
Right.
So to the point, you know, where the, you know, somebody, I forget who it is, but there's a local critic who describes what the University of Edinburgh, this is my institution, what it did in the late 1960s as a, quote, holocaust. And this is about 20 years after the end of the Second World War.
Yeah.
Describing something as a holocaust.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, that's incredible.
And then, you know, and even now, you know, you get into a cab in Edinburgh and taxi drivers will say, oh, you know, dreadful what the university did in the 1960s.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a reaction against that. There's also a lot of, you know, demographic changes. So, I mean, the city gets an awful lot wealthier, definitely, you know, like money pours in, and just the tendencies that it already had just become more and more strong.
So is it, I mean, is it at the base level, is it just people move into a place like Edinburgh for a reason and then essentially spend an awful lot of time and effort and resources trying to hold it as it is and the reasons why they came in rather than accept, or as opposed to accepting or understanding or wanting the place to evolve and change, you know, so it's applicable and appropriate for, you know, the next waves or the future waves of, you know, of incomers and those that are there. I mean, you see this a lot. I mean, the experience of Edinburgh, Cambridge, York,
Bath,
Oxford, Bath, you know, lots of, particularly some of our more historically, architecturally older cities.
Or Greenwich Village.
Greenwich Village, you know, they have these kind of preservations, which I think it isn't, and there's always a challenge between preservation and change is, you know, is ongoing, right? I mean, it's an adaptive, dynamic, functional process, to use your, you know, terminology. And, you know, sometimes, you know, hopefully we get the adaption and evolution bit wins out sometimes over preservation and maintenance.
Exactly. I mean, you would hope so. I mean, in this particular case, then it's at the moment, I think, you know, the heritage lobby is far too strong. I mean, it's always going to be there, and, you know, so it should be. It should always be.
Yeah.
But it's one of, you know, a big range of voices that there should be in terms of city design. At the moment, it's too powerful.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just turn to the processes you identify, and then talk a little bit about in more detail. You identify six in the book. You say there could be others.
Yeah.
The noticeable one that you don't include, but you reference that you don't include it. So it's not like a, you know, you've missed it and without knowing, is issues around religion and religious institutions. So you kind of parked that, partly because, which I think I agree with, is that global cities tend to be more secular in orientation. Religion plays a role, but maybe not as a dominant role as they might in other sorts of places.
I'll just say just say something about that. In the, I thought about this a lot. I think it was right, just in terms of making a coherent and reasonably short
book. Which is admirable, by the way. I mean, you know, I think short books should be prized and
I mean, it's not a ladybird book, but it's not, you know, it's not like a three volume thing. But religion I thought about a lot, and I think, you know, you put it very well. So global cities tend to be self-consciously secular cities. So, you know, for example, you know, in the case of London, then, you know, we got we've got a Muslim mayor in Sadiq Khan, who's, you know, very, very open about that. But he also, you know, positions himself as a basically secular figure. You know, that's a good model. I thought about it a lot, partly because of my own own experience. I could think of lots of places in my, you know, family background where religion would have been important, you know, in forming a city. I mean, you know, my family were, you know, in different ways. They were, you know, very much involved with the Unitarian Church in you know, going right back into the 19th century and beyond. And they were, I think it's fair to say they were part of a sort of quite an influential religious infrastructure in the northwest of England, particularly Manchester. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Manchester was a city that was basically run by Unitarians and Jews through much of the 19th century. So, I mean, they were kind of part of that, and I could think of that as a story. And I was also thinking, in Edinburgh, although you know, I've got no formal contact with the central mosque at all, I eat in the legendary mosque kitchen just about every day. And it's a cheap restaurant that's attached to the mosque, although it has a sort of semi-detached relationship.
Yeah.
And I'm acutely aware of and interested in the great Muslim diaspora that's really started to form.
Yeah.
Edinburgh, centre of Edinburgh in the last decade or so. But I didn't feel like I could write about it yet.
No. Another time. Well, maybe that's the next the next book. Yeah. You know, who knows? So let's go through the processes. I mean, some of them are more obvious than others. Mm. So and there are a couple that are not obvious at all. At least they weren't to me, which I would like to spend a bit more time on than not. But so the first two I think are more obvious.
Yeah.
So the first one is money.
Yeah.
And particularly this notion of speculation, which is obviously related to the term spectacle, which you and then the second process is in relation to power and the political power. Mm. And there, you know, interestingly, I think you talk about, you know, both buildings but also grids, the grid system, squares, public squares as manifestations. And you talk a little bit about postmodernism, which is sort of power hidden in plain sight, which is another theme that is evident and consistent in the book. So just say a little bit about money and power, and then we'll talk about a couple of the others that I think are less obvious, but I found fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Well, money and power, I mean, what else is there?
What else is there?
But,
right?
Well, the sex, but we'll talk about that.
No, but we're going to get to that.
All right, fine. But money, I mean, I think with that one, I make some points which I think are pretty straightforward there, that and they'll be familiar to anybody who's written about cities or read about them. And you know, what one is that money can produce forms which are designed to grow capital. So you know, skyscrapers are the classic examples. Mm-hmm. So I talk a lot about a very particular form of skyscraper that's emerged in recent years in New York that is, you know, incredibly exaggerated in its slimness and is, you know, basically designed to realize as much capital value from the smallest site as possible. And that has become a spectacular thing. But in relation to where we're sitting now, we're very close to the city of London. And I think one of the useful things that we can do is say about the city of London is that, it looks really weird at the moment. And, you know, lots of people have said lots of things about that. It's been a cause of great angst for critics like Simon Jenkins.
Indeed.
And, you know, people like that. I totally get it. But that in itself seemed to demand a slightly more realistic, process-oriented approach to it. So I don't think it's at all surprising that the City of London looks the way it does. I mean, the City of London, if you think about it, its role, it's the hub, the global hub for moving large amounts of foreign capital around. I mean, we all know that. So, and if you think about the amount of capital that's coming from, say, you know, China, Shanghai, or you know, Dubai, or the other places in the Arabian Peninsula, it is not at all surprising that you're going to want a place that makes itself in the image of where the money's coming from, in a way. You can add to that the fact that capital is spectacular. You know, as I argue in the book, the capital wants to make images of itself. It wants to show off and whatever. So that's exactly what the City of London is doing. And then if we had a different City of London, you know, one that wasn't focused around the movement of enormous amounts of foreign capital, I think we would have a City of London that looked very different.
Yeah, so the process is actually results in the physical manifestation that we observe. I completely agree. I think if you were an outsider, if you came to the City of London, you should be more shocked by the lack of these iconic buildings rather than the iconic buildings that are there.
Yes.
You know, there are so few of them, which is a different story and a different history that we've gone through, rather than there are, you know, there are too many, as it were.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, still, it looks, as a downtown financial area, it looks pretty small,
yeah.
actually,
yeah.
given the amount of work that it's actually doing. And, you know, clearly that is changing quite fast. But, you know, there is quite a long way to go, which may fill many people with absolute horror. But, well, yeah, what can you do? You know,
yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
It simply is what it is.
Yeah. So if that's kind of money, just say a little bit about power, Richard, and particularly the example I found fascinating in the book was your referencing to and talking about the Scottish Parliament yeah. building in relation to power and anxiousness within. Yeah. So just say something about power, but yeah. then, you know, just say a little bit about what you think about the Scottish Parliament as a manifestation.
Yeah, I mean, with power, really the chapter has two parts, and I think it may be the most sort of closely argued bit of the book. I mean, I think what I try and say is maybe a little bit more complex than what I say about capital. The it starts really by looking at some very straightforward images of power. So I think we all understand power as being representable in architectural terms through big buildings, straight lines, large squares where you can have military parades, mm-hmm. All of that stuff.
Yep.
You know, there's a repertoire of spaces that we're born to recognise almost, you know, so
yeah.
deeply part of so many world cultures. So I talk about that, and one of the key examples there is Brasilia, which I happen to know very well, and is a place that was built as a very pure representation of power, and it's all straight lines and big buildings and the rest of it.
Yeah.
What you referred to earlier as postmodern power, which is a nice expression actually, which I think I'm going to borrow. That had a very good representation, it seemed to me, in the Scottish Parliament, where right from the beginning of that process, and it's a process that I lived through. So I moved to Scotland in 2000. Right in the middle of the construction and the design and the agonising over the Scottish Parliament, that the process right from the beginning was a totally agonised one, where there was a lot of desire from right across the political spectrum to represent something that was a bit different. So to represent power as something more open, more humane, more accessible. You know, you can imagine the rhetoric.
Mm.
So, you know, we weren't going to build Brasilia in Edinburgh. We weren't going to build Tiananmen Square. We were going to build something that would be much more humane, and it would represent a new kind of politics and a new Scotland. You know, you can imagine
this
rhetoric. So all of those things went in to the process, which meant that they had to design something different. And I think they struggled with that in all sorts of ways. On top of that, Scotland being Scotland is it's a place, and I can say this now having been there for so long, it's a place where people love to talk. I think they in many ways love to talk, or we love to talk more than we love to do things. And so the process became extremely sort of involved. They kept changing their minds about what they wanted. What started out as a simple debating chamber then accreted half a dozen very big other buildings, and it became much more like a campus.
Yes.
And the result was something very much bigger, very much more expensive, but also very uncertain about what it was.
Yes.
And again, I think... to use this phrase, which I rather overuse in everyday life, but it is what it is. You know, it represents wonderfully what it actually was,
which was
a very kind of confused and anxious process.
Yes.
When nobody's really quite sure what it was or how much it was going to cost or any of those things. And where there were, I think I used the phrase anxieties of power, there was a sense that this should not be something that straightforwardly, nakedly represented power. I mean, in a sense, I wish it would.
Yes.
I wish it was more honest. There's something sort of fundamentally dishonest about a powerful political organisation pretending it's a daycare centre or something. You know, I mean, it's not exactly a daycare centre, but, you know, it has something of that quality. I mean, there's something, you know, slightly bullshitty around that. But, you know, it is what it is. And the discourse around power and politics in Scotland has been, you know, so much about the desire to create a new kind of politics, or, you know, something that is different from the old politics. Mm.
I found that example just, I mean, amongst many others, but just fascinating, as you say, again, around how processes that often are abstract or not fully articulated nevertheless manifest themselves over time in physical form, which I find
last thing about it, you knew very much from newspaper reporting of it that the committee processes around this were terrible.
Yeah,
I mean, people were not able to say what they wanted.
No,
there was always an elephant in the room. Nobody you know, nobody was getting what they wanted. It was almost like a terrible sort of family situation that needed some you know, therapeutic mediation. It was like that. And consequently, that's what we got in the end, was this building that represented this terrible situation.
Yeah, no, quite. So let's move on to one of the less obvious processes, I found, which is sex and sexual desire.
Yeah.
And what does Seinfeld tell us about how we look at cities?
Oh, right. No, that's good. I mean, I wanted to put sex in there. I mean, partly because I've written a book about sex already. I mean, I'm a book called Sex and Buildings, which I don't know whether I feel very uneasy about it, but a lot of interesting stuff came out of it. if you've seen it, I mean, anyone who's seen it will know why I feel uneasy about it, but it's an awful lot of interesting ideas came out in that, and it felt, you know, I ought to revisit some of them.
Right.
So, question about Seinfeld. Partly, I am pretty much a Seinfeld obsessive.
Who isn't? Everybody should be, right?
Exactly.
If they're not, then they should be.
They may not be,
but they should be.
No, I mean, an astonishing piece of work, really, Seinfeld, you know, every episode. So clever. But, you know, so much of that series was about the connection between sex and the city. And, of course, I mean, that idea, you know, then
becomes
a TV series.
More literal,
But, you know, every episode is about that. So it's about the circulation of desire in the city. I mean, that's a fancy academic way of putting the fact that the characters are constantly looking to hook up with other people.
Yeah.
And they are travelling all over the city to find those people, and they're having adventures which are very much conditioned by the city. So, you know, it's the bars they meet in, then, you know, these you know, differences of, you know, social position or status in the city, differences of wealth. They're exploring the city through sex. You know, they're always waking up in somebody else's apartment, and you know, there's scarcely an episode that isn't about that.
Yes.
So Seinfeld seemed like a good place to start. And then there was the episode that I start with is the notorious one called The Contest, which is about where the main characters try to refrain from masturbation for as long as possible, and they place a bet. You have to watch it.
You have to watch it.
But, you know, again, it's a sort of beautifully organised half hour where the themes of sex and the city are
And your point amongst many is, you know, those sorts of interactions can only really take place in cities because of the constant interaction with other people, the ability to get round and go into different circles, and which is definitely a kind of Seinfeld, but also a kind of more general this sort of sense of voyeurism where you're constantly observing and watching. you know, implicitly and explicitly what's going on and the people around you.
Yeah, well, there's a really good point you can make, you know, coming out of that, which is that cities have always been sexual marketplaces.
Mm. Yeah.
So literally, you know, you go to the city maybe to make money, but yep. you also go to the city to hook up.
You do.
People. It's like that's where the people are.
And there are some great economic yeah. studies that actually yeah. prove this point, yeah. right? You know, the yeah. sociological point that your emotional point you're making is actually yeah. underpinned by, you know, good economic evidence on yeah. this sort of stuff, which I find fascinating as well. But you within that you also talk about again the kind of physical manifestation of, you know, you use Manchester and Canal yeah. Street and the kind of gay village or Cargo yeah. district in San Francisco yeah. as examples about, and the boulevards of Paris yeah. actually mm. how, you know, they've both adapted and been repurposed almost by, mm. you know, by different communities as they've kind of yeah. grown and flourished and become more associated with the urban.
Yeah, yeah. No, there was a question of where to go with this chapter, you know, having set up the idea of Sex in the City, you know, what are you going to talk about?
Yeah.
You know, you've got, you know, a limited amount of space to do it. So I went for things, partly things that were familiar and I knew I could make them sort of sing. but I also went for things, particularly in the case of Manchester and Canal Street and then also the related case of the gay cruising scene in New York
in the 1970s. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, these were things where there's actually been a lot of academic mm. interest in yeah. these things. So in, you know, areas like art history and cultural studies and you know, history of photography, there's been a lot of interest in those things. And you know, it happens to be that there are you know, lots of people I particularly admire theory and stuff. They happen to be working in those areas, and some of them are sort of activists. But I felt like an observer in many ways. With Canal Street, which I know extremely well, but you know, I've always been an observer, and I'm straight, I suppose. but being in art history, then I mean, that's a world where almost nobody is. So that most of our socializing when I was based in that part of the world tended to be on Canal Street, mm. and you know, yeah. you became very conscious of a part of the city that was, you know, self-consciously making itself in relation to sex,
yeah.
and that was very self-consciously a sexual yeah. marketplace,
yeah.
and was also through its physical manifestations, it was very you know, self-consciously again. Cultivating quite a sort of fluid and open notion yeah. of sexuality,
yeah.
so you know, the sense that, you know, well, you know, whoever you were welcome in some way.
Yeah,
and all of these things were very interesting, and to see them, you know, played out in a very visual, sometimes spectacular
yeah.
form.
And many of those locations that you talk about, which mm-hmm. I find, you know, it's a kind of interesting. It becomes mm-hmm. obvious once you've said it in the book, but many of those places, Canal Street, as it were, or mm-hmm. the Hudson Yard area, New York, or the, you know, Castro District in, they were marginal places.
Yeah.
They were spaces at the edge of, mm-hmm. you know, the city, as it were, not mm-hmm. not inhabited necessarily. Not, you know, they mm-hmm. weren't part of the mainstay, and they were colonized, as it were, mm-hmm. you know, by sort of, you know, communities that probably at the time felt marginalized and yep. were trying to find spaces. So again, the kind of physical and the, you know, the social interact in the way that those places, you know, it's not slap bang in the middle of
yep.
the city, but it's not in the middle of nowhere either. Yep. It's those sort of marginal spaces, and yep. I think that's fascinating as well.
It is, you know, from a real estate perspective,
yeah.
because it's been a really important driver in, you know, Manchester, San Francisco, Sao Paulo, Brighton, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
The places that have those big gay scenes have seen, you know, very unforeseen kinds of property development. Like, you know, you go back, you know, 40, 50 years, and nobody would have said that those areas would be ripe for redevelopment.
Yeah.
So it's a sexual marketplace that has has produced them.
Yeah.
You know, nobody would have put their money on Canal Street.
Yeah. We haven't got time, but no, you sure. also talk about Lost in Translation in that context, about, you know, and the role and significance of Tokyo as the backdrop, but then becomes part of the, you know, of the group dynamic between the two main protagonists in that, which I, again, we won't say anymore, cause not least because people should get the book and read it. But I want to move on to, the next one, which is actually the fifth one you talk about.
Yeah.
But say a little bit about violence and war.
Yeah.
Richard, and again, you know, there's a significance to, you know, both cities being, you know, the recipients of, you know, where violence and war, and particularly more recently, you know, terrorism and the kind of responses to that play out. So just say a little bit about that as a process.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting question. I could easily have left that out. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought it had to go in. I think during my lifetime, that there's been a lot of big shifts in attitude towards violence in different ways. I mean, I actually think, you know, cities are much less violent, or at least global cities are much less violent than they were, much less violent.
Mm.
And talking to my kids about, you know, their experience of violence now, or, you know, do they feel frightened or what? No, I mean, I you know, my experience was as a child of their age, was of fear of violence most of the time, or participating in violence, whatever.
You know? Yeah.
So I think we're in an age where you could probably measure the reduction of certain kinds of violence. I'm fairly certain about that. Also, a very marked reduction in the presence of the military, and, you know, even in terms of the presence of the military in media terms. And I'm sure that's gone down. You know, it's lesser. That there's much less of a presumption that you know, for almost anybody in a kind of global developed economy, that the military is a reasonable option. You know, a reasonable career option.
Yeah.
I mean, in Edinburgh, oddly, you are forced to think about that a little bit, because not only is the army physically present in the centre of the city in the castle, but almost all of the private schools in the centre of the city have an officer training corps. So on Fridays, they all come to school dressed in military.
Oh, okay. Really?
It's bizarre. So suddenly you think, oh my God, there's a war going on. You know, what's going on? So it's bizarre. Anyway, but I wanted to think about it just through, because I felt that, you know, there were big changes that had happened, and that, you know, perhaps the whole sort of thinking about where war and violence were has changed a lot, and there was something distinctive going on. So the inevitable place that it ends up is in this thinking around the fear of violence, and particularly the fear of terrorism. And although, I mean, I can't remember a time when terrorism wasn't a part of my life. You know, not as a terrorist, but, you know, but I can't remember not being conditioned by that. But I remember that, you know, the 1970s as being a lot worse than this.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot worse.
Yeah.
Things have changed a bit. But the fear is very much there. And then the response to that fear has become more and more technologically sophisticated. And questions of security have become more sophisticated. Our expectations of being protected from violence are probably more elevated than they were, and that has produced in certain areas of cities a kind of siege like mentality.
Mm.
So and I it's partly I've just simply read a lot around this, and I'm interested in the way that companies like British BAE Systems, for example, that their activities have increasingly moved towards large-scale security systems, and, you know, and away from making aeroplanes.
Mm.
Or at least you know, finishing aeroplanes.
Mm.
But, you know, so their interests are, you know, very much in areas like security systems for airports, and so, you know, that's an interesting move, and then yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff like that.
I think what's been interesting, say reflection, what's been interesting is, again, you know, I take London as an example, particularly because you see this most obviously. You know, there's been a reversion to using defensive architecture,
yeah,
in order to try and safeguard some of the, or at least retrospectively, to deal with some of the issues that have emerged more recently, in relation to some of the more recent terrorist acts, which has manifestations, I suppose, in, as you say, in the 70s and 80s, when the threat was of a different nature, that had much more police, visibility on the streets. Actually, now it's using architecture and design to try and deal with some of those challenges that modern violence, I suppose, notwithstanding, it may be going down. I think it's interesting.
I mean, the other part of that chapter, I suppose, deals with the actual military,
yes,
and the way that the militaries all over the world are increasingly thinking of warfare as urban. So, you know, I grew up with the notion that warfare was going to be battlefield orientated, to do with the use of thermonuclear weapons or whatever. And now, you know, the consciousness is of something else. And oddly, after I'd written the draft of this, then over the summer I got to know an Israeli guy just on holiday. We were, my son and I were walking the tour of Mont Blanc, and we met all sorts of interesting people. This Israeli guy, quite young, he had served in the military, and he was very articulate and self-reflexive, but he had been involved in a lot of military operations in Gaza, and he talked a lot about that, and how the kind of experience that he was describing there, and it's a very sort of frightening, disturbing experiences in all sorts of ways. But what he was describing was essentially a view of warfare as essentially small-scale,
urban. Like, no, quite. I think, kind of fascinating insight. The other two, which we won't go into, more traditional, to at least to listeners of the podcast, are around work, and obviously the changing nature of work. And again, people can read it, but I think fascinating the way you talk about, almost lofts being the kind of symbol of, how, but also factories and the campuses of Silicon Valley and, Detroit's big factories and the evolution of that. And then the sixth process you identify is culture. But also I think you're the kind of turn of culture as industry and activity rather than necessarily experience. And you talk a little bit in that context, already about, Dundee and the V&A, which borrows from Bilbao and the Guggenheim or New York and, and the Frank Reich, buildings and Frank Lloyd Wright buildings and all of that, which I find fascinating. Again, loads to it. But I want to finish by, I want you to do two things. One, come back to Venice. So you don't like Venice, but if we were adopting and applying some of your approaches and thinking to Venice, how would we look at it different? What would your kind of perspective give us different than the more classic or traditional way of thinking about Venice?
Yeah, I know that's a really fascinating thing to think about. I mean, and I do have an answer. I think it would be to wrestle Venice away from the heritage lobby, to actually wrestle it away from UNESCO, and to take it somehow back to what it actually was, which was a proper global trading city. And I would want, first of all, in the way that we look at it, I would want us to be able to celebrate what it actually is, so that to be able to celebrate this, for example, the cruise ships coming up and down. I mean, they are a remarkable sight, but also to be able to recognise that the tourists are also people, and that these are huge flows are important, and that the economy is quite complex. So we need to be able to see all that stuff. But to make it actually a bearable place, we would then need to do something about it. And I think what I would want would be something of what I think, you know, occasionally the University of Venice have proposed, which would be to do, you know, some pretty large scale bits of infrastructure to help people move around. And I mean, I think, yeah, the vaporettos are rubbish. You know? I mean, they're just a horrendous way of getting around. It needs a bloody metro system.
Yeah.
I mean, no question about it. It needs, you know, really large scale infrastructure to move all of these people around. And, you know, assuming they are all going to keep coming, it needs to you know, recognize itself for what it actually is.
Yeah.
That would be good. And, you know, then it needs to become a proper city.
Well, that's not going to happen, is it?
No, of course it's not going to happen.
In a sense, the locked-in view of Venice as being this sort of, you know, city on the water, you know, slightly, you know, decrepit and, you know, and ruinous, but all the fascinating for it.
Yeah.
That's such a locked-in view of Venice that attempts to actually even improve the quality of the buildings in a sense to make them slightly less decayed is pretty much outlawed, right?
I mean, the other thing that needs to happen is that the overall quality of food needs to improve. I mean, it's an astonishingly bad place to eat. I know, people will complain about this and say, oh, you say, no, I know this place in, you know, Giudecca or whatever.
But in aggregate, right?
In aggregate, it's
which is where we have to
hopeless.
Get to.
Hopeless. Yeah. I mean, I love food and I love eating in cities and this is... It's one of the worst places
on Earth. That's a great way to finish. My guest today has been Richard Williams. Richard, thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter, at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.